From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Adam Ragusa. Deadly crashes in Georgia feel like an all-too-common occurrence.
Over here, this white van struck that vehicle, lost control, and then flipped over several times. The driver of the van was ejected from the vehicle and died on the scene.
Well, today we're going to look at an uptick in motor vehicle deaths in the state. And we'll also hear about how the autonomous vehicle industry may make Georgia's roads safer. But first, we talked earlier in the week about Georgia's wildlife, from the bushy-tailed variety that climb our trees to the ancient shelled kind that swim off of our shores. My colleague Celeste Headley spoke with Jamie Allen. He came up with the idea for a squirrel census, an effort to count Atlanta's squirrel population. Jamie says he's wondered about how many squirrels call Atlanta home.
They're great athletes, so nobody even had the slightest idea, which I thought was kind of funny because we do kind of know like how many rats are around, right? We have an estimate on that.
Good idea. Here at Mercer University, where I teach, the students like to joke that squirrels outnumber them on campus. Anyway, that segment got at least one of you thinking about the rat population. Here are your first thoughts.
Hey, this is Bob. I have some dear friends from France, and when they were visiting a few years ago, we were driving and came around a curve and saw a very large possum crossing the road, and they were very excited and wanted to know what kind of animal it was. And I said, wow, that's a big rat. They were quite excited about the giant rats we have here in the South.
Rodents of unusual size? I don't think they exist. Thanks for that, Bob. Hopefully our furry friends are also listening. We always want to know what you think. Call us at 404-500-9457. That's 404-500-9457. We're also on Twitter at OST Talk, or you can post to facebook.com/onsecondthoughtradio, and we might feature your comments on the show. Mr. Tuck and the 13 Heroes is a new children's book about the first school in Henry County, Georgia, to integrate black and white students. In 1966, Fairview Elementary accepted 13 students of color, an effort that was led by then-principal Brooks Tuck. The author of the book is John Harris, whose father was friends with Mr. Tuck, and he joins me now along with the illustrator, who just happens to be John Harris's daughter, Sophie Harris. Hi to both of you.
Hello.
Hi.
Who was Mr. Tuck? Tell me about this principal at the center of this book.
Sure. Thanks for having us. Brooks Tuck had been a close friend of my parents in the later years of his life. And not only did he teach at Mercer, in fact, like you do, during the latter part of his career, he also was a member of, he and his wife Shirley were in the same Sunday school class that my parents were in. And at one point a few years ago, or maybe 10 or so years ago, a particular class discussion led Shirley to say something like this. I'm going to tell you a story, and Brooks is not going to like me telling it, but I'm going to tell it anyway. And then she went on to tell the story that ultimately became the story of this book. And she said that Brooks never really liked telling that story much himself because he didn't want to be seen as the hero. And to him, it was the children involved in this particular story that were the heroes. He was an educator and teacher and principal in Henry County and DeKalb County, in fact, for close to 50 years.
So let's do the short version of the story. Henry County was one of the last places to integrate. There were a straggler. Brown versus Board of Education happened in 1954, mm-hmm. and then Henry County integrated in 1966
right.
with just this one school. What happened?
Right. In 1965, actually, we've learned since then that the Henry County High School was the first school in the county to accept African American students. There were three of them, but it turns out that Fairview was the first elementary school in the county. And Mr. Tuck was someone who thought that all children should have access to the best possible education. And he was quick to volunteer his school to be one of the schools to accept black children. And this was not very popular for him or for the community. As you might imagine, there were many people around at that time that did not really want that to happen. And he did it anyway. And it was awfully tough for him, for his wife Shirley, and for their son Mike,
They were threatened.
They were harassed. Very threatened. Yeah, they people called them and you know said that they had put bombs in their car. They painted ugly things on the road outside their houses. They threatened to hurt their son Mike, who was also a student at Fairview at the time. So it was not easy for them.
And just in case we need to spell this out for people, Principal Tuck was white.
Yes.
And you know, in the book, we see a school bus full of 13 young black kids roll up on the first day.
Mm-hmm.
And Sophie, you're the illustrator of the book, and you've drawn protesters, people who are upset about the integration,
yes,
just outside of the bus, and you sketch them almost very minimally. You sketch them like angry stick figure people. I wonder if that's what you're trying to communicate with that choice.
It was, because I wanted more emphasis on the 13 children, and there were so many protesters, so it was impossible to, you know, pack them all in.
Yeah, yeah. It's almost dehumanizing to the protesters, which
exactly.
I think is an interesting and a legitimate artistic choice, right? Because
it
their
was.
Actions dehumanize themselves. Yeah. So the 13 kids pull up in the bus, and then what happens?
Well, this happened a few weeks into the first to the school year, and all of the people who had already, all the white kids were already at school that day, and then when the bus pulled up that had the 13 children, the 13 black children in it, they faced the crowd that you have described and Sophie has illustrated of people protesting and holding up signs. Shirley Tuck, Mr. Tuck's wife, was actually there at the time, and she describes people there as having ropes and guns and holding up signs to intimidate the children. And Mr. Tuck, when he saw the bus arrive, he stepped out onto the curb and walked through that throng of chaos and stepped up onto the bus and spoke to the children, and one by one brought each child hand in hand or by carrying some of the smaller ones up to the front of the school and opened the door. Get them safely inside, locked the door, went right back, and did it again. And he made 13 trips to the bus that morning to walk each of those children in and to try to help them understand that this was their school and that he wanted them there.
Personally escorting them one by one and feeling so threatened as he crossed the picket line that he locked the school door behind him. Each
mm-hmm.
trip is what you say in the book.
That's right. That's what he described, yeah.
It's really a dramatic scene that you sketch.
Yeah.
And then there's sort of a twist ending, and maybe we'll spoil it, maybe we won't. We'll cross the bridge when we get there. But right now I'll remind listeners that I'm speaking with John and Sophie Harris. They are the author and illustrator, respectively, of the new children's book, Mr. Tuck and the 13 Heroes. It tells the story of the first public school or the first public elementary school in Henry County, Georgia, to integrate. That didn't happen until 12 years after Brown versus Board of Ed. Sophie, tell me about how you approached visualizing these people. Were you able to find out how they looked at the time? Were there historical photographs?
I did a lot of research for the time period, and Mrs. Tuck, Shirley, actually provided me a lot of photographs, some of the family, some of the children at the time, and she was really helpful. So then I just put them all together. And I wanted to give them each a unique face, too, because they're all unique people.
Yeah, I appreciate that very much about your illustration. Everyone is individually drawn, and I mean that both literally and figuratively. One thing that really catches my attention is the eyes. You have to show a lot of emotion in eyes in this. And again, like the sort of, you know, angry white protesters, you just kind of give them these almost nondescript, cartoonish, angry eyes. But all of the other characters, you give these very human, very almost, you know, stylized but realistic renderings of worry and fear and anxiety in their eyes that I find very moving.
Exactly. And the eyes are the window to the soul.
As they say.
Mm-hmm.
So, let's go ahead and talk about the ending. So some time goes by from this whole incident, and Mr. Tuck has to go into the hospital. He's very, very sick. And what happens?
Yes, the way he tells the story and the way that we tried to copy it in the book is that he got sick and had to be in the hospital for a little while. And He got better, but still needed to stay there. And while he was in the hospital, he noticed that there were often lots of doctors, nurses, and family and friends coming to visit him. And as he was coming to one time, I think he noticed that there was one particular nurse that had seemed to be there a lot, sometimes during the day, sometimes at night. And the nurse was named Melinda. And at one point, he told Melinda, he said, "You know, you don't need to be here all this time. I've got plenty of people to help take care of me." And Melinda looked at him and said, "Mr. Tuck, you don't recognize me, but I sure do know you. You held my hand and walked with me to my first day at Fairview Elementary, and you didn't leave me on that day, and I'm not going to leave you." And so it was it's a striking moment that really just makes the story. The story was that of their experience was remarkable anyway, but the fact that there's this closure in a way just really makes the story extra, extra special.
It's misty in here. Yeah, as lovely and moving as that is, I do wonder if you guys, as you were working on this children's book of this story, were a bit conscious of the risk that it might come across as the kind of white savior narrative that a lot of people find offensive these days. And in fact, Mr. Tuck himself in the book says, "I'm not the hero of the story. It's the kids. They're the hero." And yet you guys have made Mr. Tuck the protagonist of your story.
Yeah, he really wanted to make sure then and in his later years, that he was not the hero here. And when we spoke with him about making the children's book, or you know, he was always reluctant, I think, as I mentioned before, to share this story because it's natural, I think, to identify the single savior in any kind of story, really. Mm-hmm. And protagonists are easy to form. In our own minds, even in the place, or in a place where there may be many more. But I think one of the things that that we hope people still continue to do is to honor Mr. Tuck's wish as well, and recognize that those children were awfully brave, and they were the real heroes, as he said. I think Sophie, one of the things that I really liked about the way she drew the children was you could see it in their faces, you could see it in their body language that they were scared, and to put ourselves in that place, I think helps us to realize that as Mr. Tuck would say, they were the ones that were the brave ones.
Yeah, and Mr. Tuck passed away in 2012.
He did. Shirley, his wife, is still alive and was very helpful for us in the, as Sophie mentioned, in putting together the having images for us to think about. Their son Mike, who I mentioned was a child, was a student at Fairview at the time, mm-hmm. was very helpful as well in terms of helping us to understand some of the details of the day mm-hmm. and of the time.
Well, it's a lovely book. I appreciate your work on it, guys. I'll read it to my my son tonight.
Wonderful.
Been speaking with John Harris, author of the new children's book, Mr. Tuck and the 13 Heroes. His daughter Sophie illustrated it. Thanks so much to you guys. Just ahead, motor vehicle deaths in Atlanta have spiked over the last 30... Excuse me. Motor vehicle deaths in Atlanta have spiked over 30% in recent years. We're going to find out why. It's On Second Thought. I'm Adam Ragusea in today for Celeste Headlee. 238 years ago, the British Army made its first push into the American South. It happened near the present-day city of Sylvania. That's about halfway between Augusta and Savannah. The battle ended in a British victory, but today in the woods along Briar Creek, another battle is being waged over threats to the preservation of this historic 500-acre site. To discuss the history and what's at stake, Celeste Headlee spoke with Daniel Battle from the Georgia American Revolution Preservation Alliance. His wife, Daphne Owens, also joined the conversation. She's the lead archaeologist on the Briar Creek Project. Here's that conversation.
Well, Daniel, why don't we start with a history lesson on what exactly the Battle of Briar Creek was and why it's important?
Okay. The Battle of Briar Creek was fought on March the 3rd, 1779, along the Savannah River in what is now Screven County. It was one of Georgia's most defining and significant Revolutionary War battles. The story of Georgia's participation.
Why do you say it was one of the most defining and significant?
Because it was really the first real land battle of the Southern campaign that happened when the British changed strategies, invaded the South, and it was the battle that really sort of decided Georgia's capture for the British, the British sovereignty of the British Empire. So when Georgia fell, it was considered, it was declared after this battle.
And it's been called the end of the Georgia Continentals. What does that mean?
The Georgia Continentals were, your first U.S. soldiers. And, they were equipped by the Continental Congress. And then you had the Georgia Militia. But the Georgia Continentals are your first U.S. soldiers. They bear some of the first times that you see U.S. on any of their insignias. So they were supposedly a professional trained group of soldiers that when battle broke, they were not expected to retreat or leave their lines once they were in place.
And Daphne, some digging has already gone on at this site. What has been found and what do you think might still be under the ground?
Well, most of our field work was done with metal detectors, and we limited our search to the top, basically 20 centimeters of the soil, in order to determine where the battlefield was. And the reason we did that was because that area has been plowed in the past. It's formerly agricultural field, and now it's timberland. And the top 20 centimeters has already been disturbed. It's been churned over time. And so that area is already disturbed. So when we go out there and do our field work and do the metal detecting and dig those artifacts up, we are digging artifacts that are relatively close to where they were dropped, but not necessarily exactly where. And so we're not really disturbing the integrity of the battlefield as much. And so primarily we did our metal detector, and we tried to do a reconnaissance over the entire battlefield, which at this point is really, really large, several hundred acres. And then we tried to, once we found areas that looked like they might have been part of the battlefield, we would focus our efforts more in a more detailed manner in smaller areas to try to get a better idea of what activities we were looking at. And we found a tremendous amount of activity areas on the battlefield. We found areas where the battle actually took place, where there was hand-to-hand combat. We found the areas where the American camp was set up, and then it was moved and set up again. We found an area where some of the soldiers were actually manufacturing musket balls, some historic house sites that were used before and during and even after the battle. And the most phenomenal thing that we were able to find were the picket stations where there were soldiers sent out to provide, to kind of look out for the enemy while the rest of the camp was able to go about its regular routine of training and setting up tents and things like that. And so we also have those picket stations which actually lay quite a distance from the camp. So the battlefield's really big, and we have all of the elements of a major battlefield pretty much understood at this point of where they're located.
Why do some think that there might be some grave sites there, that there might be some soldiers,
right?
238-year-old soldiers' bodies
buried?
Why do we think that?
Well, there's two reasons. First of all, we know that there were between 150 and 200 veterans that were killed during the battle. And when, generally speaking, at this period of time, when people were killed in battle, they were generally buried on the battlefield. And we actually have historic documents from the British, and then even the Americans came and found additional dead. And they actually buried those relatively close to where they were fallen because they didn't have, embalming practices and stuff that were commonly used. And so the bodies, of course, would get pretty gross pretty quickly. And so they generally buried those people right on the battlefield. And the second thing is, during our study, we actually worked with a lady named Tracy Sargent, and she brought her cadaver dogs out to the battlefield. And over a very small period of time, we were able to look at a very small piece of the battlefield, and her dogs were able to find five potential burial locations, and it was duplicated by both of the dogs that she was using. So she had replication in her results. So
there's still a scent for dogs to pick up 238 years later.
I was very suspicious of this when it was recommended to us by another Revolutionary War historian. And I was a little dubious about whether or not this would work, but we have proven that it will work. And in fact, since we did this study, we have taken Tracy Sargent to a couple of other American Revolutionary battlefields, and in a couple of instances, we actually knew where a couple of mass graves were, and her dogs indeed were able to alert on those graves. So we have seen her in action several times, and we've been very impressed with her results.
So, Daniel, what is threatened for the battlefield? Why is it in danger of not being preserved?
Well, as Daphne just quoted, the graves that are out there, we believe that there's at least 200 graves out there. We believe that they're not only likely in mass graves, but in small individual graves. And these are U.S. soldiers. These are not just regular citizens in a graveyard. These are American soldiers. And any time that you go out there and you tree cut or you run bulldozers through these areas, these graves are shown to be shallow resources. Some of these skeletal remains might be in phenomenal condition. We don't know. They may be in really good condition. We've seen some other areas like Briar Creek where they have been found to be in very well intact skeletal remains. We might be able to do facial, reconstruction and even DNA testing. Some of these were citizens of Georgia and families of Georgia. I think it's very important that these types of resources are fully protected especially under the state burial laws.
So, but what is going to threatened against the site? Why is the development occurring? Why might we lose some of these historic places?
Well, it's pretty much this has been an area that's been a tree farming operation for years by various people. And trees are harvested, not very year to year, but usually like every decade or so. And the state when they purchased this property, it appears that they wanted to continue that operation, to tree farm for profit, and also use the property for hunting management reasons. They've already said that they're not going to stop that operation. And they said they're only going to preserve 5 acres of the site, and that completely endangers all the other resources that we've noted in our research.
Daphne, you, among others, have said that 500 acres need to be preserved to really set this this site of the battle aside. Why that large a space?
Well, because this is a really unique opportunity, because the battlefield is completely intact for the most part. All of the elements of the battlefield, like I outlined earlier, are all there. Most of it, the vast majority of it is already owned by the state of Georgia. It's public land. It doesn't have to be bought in little pieces and tried to be put together as a battlefield. The whole battlefield is there, and it is part of a much larger wildlife management area, a very small piece. It sounds like a lot of acres to us, but we're talking about a wildlife management area that is thousands and thousands and thousands of acres. And we're just asking for the area of the battlefield to be preserved, because it is a unique opportunity where the battlefield is relatively intact. The rural setting is intact. There's not a lot of encroachment. You don't have a lot of visual intrusions. And you have all of the elements of the battlefield represented in the battle, on the battlefield. And so it's a complete package. And without that complete package, you just really won't get the feel and the context of what it was like to be on that battlefield on March 3rd, 1779.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with archaeologist Daphne Owens about the Battle of Briar Creek, and also Daniel Battle from the Georgia American Revolution Preservation Alliance. So, Daniel, let me play devil's advocate here for just a moment, mm-hmm. and say that, look, there's history that's occurred on almost every square inch of the American nation, and we can't preserve all of it.
Right.
So what do you say to someone who might say, look, 500 acres is a massive area?
Well, in Georgia, we have a real preservation crisis and and a, you know, something that's been going on for many years, where there hasn't been literally any Revolutionary War sites in Georgia protected whatsoever. And I mean, we have more battlefields dedicated to the war, Jenkins' ear, than we have the Revolutionary War. And you know, I don't expect people to know very much what the war Jenkins' ear was, and that's the point. But, you know, the Battle of Briar Creek is listed as the 16th bloodiest battle of the American Revolution. So after this battle was Georgia was declared to be the only state to be officially recognized back into British sovereignty. And we were the only state to have that happen of all the 13 colonies. You know, that's another very significant point. And the battle itself, the entire battle, the whole picture, this was the first American offensive against the British in the entire southern theater of the war. You know, there was no way that you would ignore the first time that the brand new American, you know, army moves against an enemy, and, you know, that's just of extreme historical importance.
So, Daphne, what do you hope you could learn? Let's say they preserved the battlefield, that you were able to excavate and bring up all of these artifacts and sites that you were describing earlier. What do you think you could learn from it?
Well, we could learn a lot more about the various activities that were done on the battlefield, where events happened, where people were attacked. We could find out which groups were involved, whether or not there were African Americans involved, whether or not there were any Indian groups involved in the fighting. We could find out exactly where the Revolutionary War soldiers, where they fell on the battlefield and where they're buried, so we could actually commemorate them and give them their just rewards for serving our country. And most importantly, I believe we could, you know, educate the public. I don't think many people out there in Georgia even understand that part of the Revolutionary War was fought in the state of Georgia, a very significant part. And, you know, and it's a thing for Georgians to be proud of. And even though we lost that battle, which we believe may be part of the reason it has been lost to history, we lost that battle. But, you know, there was a lot of heroes involved in the battle. General Samuel Elbert almost lost his life there, and a lot of his Continental soldiers that served with him, you know, bravely stood against a British army that completely overran them, you know, and it's just a point of pride, and we need to educate Georgians and even the rest of the country that the South also played a role in the American Revolution, and that, you know, it's not just all about Concord and Lexington and some of those places up north.
Daniel, you have been reaching out to the state and the Department of Natural Resources. What are you asking for? What do you want to see happen with this? You're asking also for 500 acres to be preserved. What do you want it to look like? Do you want it to be the kind of organized, notated park like when you visit Gettysburg?
Well, the one part that really stands out to me is the Monmouth Battlefield in New Jersey. You know, I realize there's budget problems and budget issues all the time, but there's no reason that this site should not have a management plan placed on it to where it spells out how they're going to be careful with the site and not damage it any further than they already have. That means, like, being careful with the way they use tractors out there. You know, you can use rubber wheel tires instead of big metal linked chain kind of tires.
And Daphne, what kind of process are we talking about? What kind of commitment in terms of time would it take to excavate all those using rigorous standards, make sure that they've discovered any places where a soldier may have fallen and lay?
Yeah, it's a multiple-step process, and the first one is actually the one we started and we're not able to finish, and that's bringing the cadaver dogs in. That would eliminate, for the most part, large areas that there would be no, you know, most likely no burials, but the dogs would alert on the areas that were most suspect. And then we could actually, you know, take backhoes or something of that sort, and, of course, you know, the state owns a tremendous number of backhoes. You could get a backhoe out there and scrape back the areas until you were able to find the correct staining in the soil that would indicate that the ground has been, you know, removed in an area that would have allowed the burial of cadavers. So the first step would be to take the cadaver dogs back. The second one would be to actually ground truth to identify whether or not those areas that the dogs alerted were actually where there are burials and exactly where they're at, because the dog alerts scent travels, and so the dogs may alert in one area, but the burials may be, you know, 10 feet away or something like that. So we need to do a good job pinpointing exactly where those burials are. And then hopefully at that point, when funds become available, if anyone is interested, maybe we can do some type of study on the cadavers to find out how they were killed, how brutal some of their death blows may have been, how cut up they are, so to speak. And then hopefully at some point we'd actually be able to put out put some monuments out there on each one of the individual mass and or individual burials that are there. So it is a multi-step process, but certainly the first one is easy enough. Identify the approximate locations and cord them off and make sure they're not disturbed any further. And then as funds become available, you can do some of the other steps.
That's Daphne Owens, an archaeologist, and also historian Daniel Battle. They're working to preserve the Briar Creek battlefield, the historic site where the Georgian Continental Army lost to the British during the American Revolution. Daphne and Daniel, thank you both so much.
You're very welcome. We're glad to have someone to talk to, and we hope that the state of Georgia will do something with this significant resource.
That was Celeste Headley speaking with historian Daniel Battle and his wife, archaeologist Daphne Owens. They're working to preserve the Briar Creek battlefield. That's the historic site where the Georgian Continental Army lost to the British during the American Revolution. We also reached out to Brian Tucker from the Georgia Department of Natural Resources. In an email, he said they are working to balance preservation with other interests. He also says they recognize the importance of the role the battle played in our nation's history. Just ahead, Atlanta is taking steps to become the next big hub for self-driving cars. This is On Second Thought. It's On Second Thought. I'm Adam Ragusea in today for Celeste Headley. The motor vehicle death rate in Georgia has jumped by more than 30% since 2014. That is the fifth highest jump over that time period in the nation, where comparatively fatalities rose only 14% nationwide. Those disappointing numbers come from a National Safety Council study released last month. The top three killers, no big surprises here, speed, alcohol, and distraction. Sadly, that's nothing new. We've invited Natalie Dale to shed some light on this. She's a spokesperson for the Georgia Department of Transportation. Hi, Natalie.
Hi, Adam. How are you?
Doing all right. What do you make of these numbers? Do we think that this is something real, or is it just a blip?
Well, it's definitely something that has gotten our attention. And it's important to note when they say that 30% jump, that nationally, we were actually still trending down in 2014 when all other states were sort of taking that turn upward. And so we have now taken that turn to where we have increased fatalities. But in 2014, we were still riding that downward trend. Now, of course, gas prices are low, more jobs, so you have more people on the road. But what's shocking to us isn't that there's more people on the road and so there's an increase in fatalities. It's the types of accidents that we're seeing that are causing these fatalities that have really sort of rung that alarm bell and have us scratching our heads, and we've started the Drive Alert Arrive Alive campaign as a way to educate people about what we're seeing on the road today.
Okay, tell me about those types of accidents that you think might be behind this increase.
Well, a couple of things that we're seeing, and that is the majority of fatalities are single vehicle accidents or roadway departures. So single vehicle roadway departures or single vehicle accidents where I'm not running into you, I'm just running off the road, or I'm running out of my lane, or I'm running into a bridge. And so it's a sole vehicle, which can be a direct correlation to distracted driving. Anyone who's driven on the road today, we were just talking about this, look around. People are on their phones. They're on their devices. They're doing something that is taking their attention off the road. And then another thing that we're looking at, which is really startling to me, because when I get in the car, the first thing I do is put on my seatbelt. That's just become second nature.
Sure.
Over half of these fatalities are people who are not wearing their seatbelt. So
wow.
Where have we gotten off base with that? Where have people become so comfortable in a car that they're not buckling up, that they're doing something besides paying attention to the road? These are things that we have got to address, because we have seen an increase in fatalities in 2 years, and it is distracted driving. But 2 years does not a trend make. So we can turn this around, but we have to educate people now, and people have to start putting the phone down.
Any theories as to why? I mean, these phenomena that you're talking about, gas prices going down, therefore more people drive, and therefore there are more accidents. That's a national phenomenon. People texting on their phones when they really, really shouldn't. That's a national phenomenon. Any theories as to why, at least over this relatively small window of time in which we're looking at the data, the increase seems to be particularly bad here in Georgia?
Well, we have seen an increase in congestion and increase in people on the road. And so going back to, it's not just that there's more people on the road. And I don't want to get too caught up in the fact of, well, it's 30% or, well, it's 15% increase. The fact that there is an increase is something that is startling and something that we need to get control over, whether that's one people or 100 people. Those are people who are not going home to their families. And so whether it's one person or 100 people, those lives are all important. And so it's something we have got to begin to get control of. And so, again, to some of those theories, it's people think that what's going on their phone, people think that there's something more important than being an attentive driver. And we've got to turn the ship on that attitude that there's something more important to do than simply pay attention to driving.
So you've mentioned that GDOT is working on an awareness campaign. Are you coordinating at all with Georgia State Patrol? Are there enforcement initiatives that they can do to try to tackle this problem?
Of course, we have partnerships with Georgia State Patrol, Governor's Office of Highway Safety, Georgia DOT. We are all doing what we can to sort of raise awareness and educate about what's going on our roads. Of course, meeting with schools. You would think that this might be a problem for a younger generation, a generation that's just starting to drive, but we're seeing it across the board. And so we're having to be creative in our educational methods, and it's something we'll continue to look at. It's something that is a high priority to us, obviously, safety.
I mean, texting while driving is illegal in Georgia, right?
Texting while driving is illegal in Georgia, but you still see it. And that again, is the problem. And I have a lot of people that I know say, oh, I know it's dangerous. And studies have shown that people know it's dangerous, but they still do it. How many people out there say, well, I'm actually a really good driver when I text? So someone else may be an unsafe driver, but I'll keep texting. No one is a safe driver when they're texting. I don't care how proficient at texting you are. No one is a good driver when you're on your phone. You are the best driver when you are paying attention to everything that's going on the road around you. And so we really just have to begin to change that mentality.
Well, I want to put in a plug for hands-free activities while one is in the car, such as listening to the radio. And I've been speaking with Natalie Dale, spokesperson for the Georgia Department of Transportation. Thank you so much, Natalie.
Thank you.
Speaking of cars, the autonomous vehicle industry may soon find a home in Atlanta. The city is one of three worldwide cities chosen for the Safer Roads Challenge. It's an effort bringing together manufacturing and tech companies in a common goal of making traffic safer. Part of that initiative is the implementation of self-driving cars. With me to talk about this is Faye DeMassimo, general manager of the Renew Atlanta Bond. That's the City of Atlanta's department responsible for improving infrastructure. Hi, Faye.
Good morning.
Good morning to you. Also with us to talk about self-driving cars is Michael Hunter, professor of civil and environmental engineering at Georgia Tech. Hi, Michael.
Good morning.
Start with you, Michael. Just in theory, why do we think that autonomous vehicles might make roads safer? I think it's a lot of people find it instinctively, on an instinctive level, we find it rather terrifying.
Sure. The general concept is that there's been seen that 90% or so of accidents at least have human error as a potential contributing cause. And if you can have a self-driving vehicle and remove that human from that loop, you have the potential to greatly reduce the number of crashes, which in turn will greatly reduce the number of serious injuries and fatalities, as was just being talked about.
But as many times as I make a mistake in my day, the electronic devices in my life make even more mistakes. Like, do we know, is there data from the very little experience that the human race has had with autonomous vehicles up to this point to indicate that they actually would be safer in a real urban traffic environment?
Well, this is the question, and this is what the industry and the agencies are all looking at right now, is to try to determine, when you compare these vehicles against a human driver, what do we see? We certainly have places for advantages. For instance, you don't have attention issues, you don't have distraction issues when you look at the technology. So from that perspective, clearly you can see an advantage over the human driver, although then you're going to have other areas where, you know, issues can be confusing. There can be conflicting signs, or there can be a issue with the striping on the roadway, and you're going to have to ask some questions on how well the vehicle can handle that sort of conflicting information, and how well they're going to traverse through that situation. So, I mean, the jury is still out. I believe certainly long term that the technology will be able to prove to a point that, yeah, will provide a safer service than the a standard driver. But right now, is it there? Well, that's what's being tested. That's a lot of what's going on these days.
So, Faye, tell us briefly about the goal of this Safer Roads Initiative and how self-driving cars might fit into that.
Of course, as you mentioned earlier, the city of Atlanta was very honored to be one of only three cities in the world selected for this effort. And one of the things that the group that came in, that was made up of a collaborative of industry leaders who were interested in safer roads and safer transportation systems worldwide, one of the things that they really developed and that we are now in the process of testing is a tool that allows us to look at corridors throughout the city, but we're focusing on North Avenue right now as our pilot, to look at it from a predictive fashion. So things like weather, things like congestion, things like historical data, things like events that may be going on in an area, and that based upon all of that information, we can be predictive rather than reactive to when accidents happen. We can be more predictive about where we're likely to see unsafe conditions or safety concerns that are developing in a way that we can begin to address those very proactively.
So give me an example of how that could play out. Your computer model tells you, hey, there's going to be a sudden rainstorm in a given traffic area in the middle of rush hour. This is prime opportunity for an accident. Then what do you do with that information?
Oh, a couple of things. One, we could, for example, make sure that we deploy some of our maintenance resources to that area in the city to be able to make sure that storm drains are free and clear, that there's not going to be a flooding situation in a particular area. We could also deploy additional public safety resources to a particular area to just provide more. We all know that we drive a little differently when we see the public safety officials sitting right there. So
sure do.
Those kinds of things that can be done to put assets and resources that are very targeted to what the issue is in a way that helps to overcome the safety challenge.
I suppose bringing it back to autonomous vehicles, that one of the other reasons why self-driving cars would be attractive to a city like Atlanta, apart from purely the issue of safety, is congestion. You know, one of the reasons that we have to, when we drive, we need to leave a lot of buffer around ourselves in case of unpredictable human behavior. But if you have a large volume of cars being traveling under computer control, they can theoretically drive much closer together, thus easing congestion. Do I have that right, Michael?
Yeah, there's actually a lot of debate when we start going down the congestion side of this. There's an issue with who is driving. So is it just that car? Is it just autonomous cars in the roadway? Or are there also people driving their own cars? And once I go to a mixed environment, the assumptions start getting different, right? Can I really have these vehicles with very close headways when some of the vehicles in that stream may actually have a human driver? So the congestion issue, the jury's still out on where that might actually go.
So, Faye, how is the city looking at the possible implementation of self-driving cars? Obviously, there are any number of regulatory hurdles that would have to be cleared first. Is the city open to the idea?
Absolutely. One of the things that we're working on right now, as I mentioned, is we've got a smart corridor pilot project that's a part of our overall smart city effort on North Avenue from the Georgia Tech campus up to the Ponce City Market. And so all of the things that you need to have in a corridor like that, the resurfacing, the striping, the signage, the adaptive signals or signals that are smart signals, so signalization improvements, all the things that are necessary to both improve current vehicular traffic, but also to be able to test particularly driver-assisted or driver-supported autonomous vehicle demonstrations are something that we want to explore as a part of that smart corridor effort. So when we cut the ribbon on this project in September, we already have about a half a dozen both manufacturers and services that are committed to hosting those kinds of demonstrations as a part of that project implementation.
And how soon do you think, theoretically, you could be testing a semi-autonomous or autonomous vehicle on that pilot street?
We will be doing it in September, and we'll be hosting some things prior to that. But again, this will be a pilot situation where we'll be testing it to see how well our infrastructure works with it, because the infrastructure is a key part of the operations. And then looking at, you know, how the industry continues to develop. One other thing that we've been doing is working with the legislature this session that considered, you were talking about the regulatory hurdles that needed to be overcome. And our legislature is thinking ahead and proactively, I think, and are looking at the kinds of legislative pieces that need to be in place that allow for the technology to develop, allow for the innovation, the open to business environment that we're really known for in Georgia, but at the same time are also contemplating all of the insurance and liability and those kinds of issues that need to be thought of as well.
You mentioned business. This isn't really in either of yours wheelhouses, but I think that we got to acknowledge that the potential implementation of self-driving vehicles could have enormous impacts on our economy. Not all great. Is it logical to think that, for example, the logistics industry, the trucking industry, which is so enormous for Georgia, could see massive job losses as a result of widespread implementation of this technology, which we acknowledge might not happen for a long time? But is that a logical assumption to make?
I think great point to bring that up, and that is something that we've already been thinking about. I think one of the things that we've all learned from the automation that occurred even in the last few decades is we've seen that worker displacement issue across several industries, and we understand that that could be an issue here. So one of the things that the city is doing, I think, in a very proactive, very visionary kind of way, is thinking ahead to what are some of those industry impacts that we might see, whether it's trucking or otherwise, logistics industries, as you mentioned, and how can we begin to work with industry leaders? How can we work with policy? And how can we work with the actual improvements in a way that we offset any of those displacements that might occur?
Michael Hunter from Georgia Tech, last question to you. Just put on your what kind of hat does a fortune teller wear? Put on your fortune teller costume. Touch your hand to the crystal ball. All right, I'm going to land this metaphor, I swear. When do you think that we're going to see autonomous vehicles in wide use on American streets?
Well, I think at different levels of autonomy, and you're already starting to see some of it right now. It's coming, and it's not going to go away. I suspect, in the next few years, you're going to see a lot more controlled experiments and controlled pilot studies where it's not going to be the individual vehicle having an autonomous car necessarily parked in their driveway, but it's going to be the use of, the idea of autonomous trolleys and things along those lines.
Ubers,
yeah. And you could sort of think about that as, Uber, UberX, UberPool. There's a lot of different versions of that. Because the big unknown in a lot of this is actually, what is this going to look like in terms of a market? Will people actually buy their own car? And there's some significant questions about that. It's probably more likely that you're going to have something along the lines of a mobility service. Think something like Uber, and you're just going to use your phone, hit an app, and boom, your car shows up. But in something like that, you end up in a fleet management situation, which really does enable the technology to move and actually penetrate a lot quicker, because you're not looking at the individuals buying the vehicles, but really a fleet approach to the challenge. So it could be in the closer future than we think it is.
Michael Hunter is a professor of civil and environmental engineering at Georgia Tech. Also with us was Faye DeMassimo, who oversees the City of Atlanta's department responsible for improving infrastructure. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And that's it for our show today. But of course, we always want to hear to you. Would you use a self-driving car? Would you buy one? Would you just summon one with your smartphone? Are you comfortable with that kind of sacrifice of control? Call us at 404-500-9457. Find us on Facebook, on Twitter, at OST Talk. For today, that's On Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Adam Ragusea. Celeste Hadley is back at you tomorrow.